Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you ComWest Speaks. Greetings and welcome, O Setna of Kemet, a.k.a. ComWest.
Thank you, almighty Hercules, atop Mount Olympus. It's so wonderful to speak with you again. I am speaking from my temple room here in beautiful downtown Newark, New Jersey. Probably for one of the last... I'm sorry, I'm full of laughter tonight. Probably for one of the last times that we'll be doing blog talk from this perch. As you all know, perhaps, I'm relocating to Savannah, Georgia, which will be warmer, more Egyptian-like, as far as I'm concerned, and a place of much more rest and comfort. So I'm looking forward to this. I am not looking forward to not being able to be in as close contact to New York City and to all my friends that live here in the North. I am, by choice, becoming a Southerner. So this is an interesting development, I would say.
And you're always still a phone call away or an email message or email away?
Right. And you can just Zoom literally over, and I'll be right there. So I'm not leaving this, our production company. I am leaving the area. That's all. Nothing will really change except I think I'll be more relaxed and living in a place that's beautiful. I'm told Savannah is beautiful. And it's very much like Egypt. It's hot and humid. And behind me, I'm sure you're hearing, I have a meditation music which I've discovered, which is surrounded by the Eye of Horus, which, of course, is very important to me. Tonight's topic would be the starry gods. I want to address something. A lot of people have been talking about, you know, ancient deities and their connection with ancient aliens. And I've come to the conclusion after much meditation and much research that I think this is true. The Egyptian gods and goddesses are all depicted either painted gold or green. But as many of you know, the gods and goddesses of Egypt, by and large, have different faces. Many of them, like Anubis and Set, Hathor, Bast, Tehute, Thoth, if you wish, wear what I call animal head masks. Many times the heads on these paintings or depictions or statues are a little larger than the body, just enough where you could see where it might be a mask. It's been brought to my thoughts that maybe it's not a mask. Maybe it's a space helmet. Maybe they're doing that so they can breathe better in an atmosphere that's unnatural to them. So I, in my research, have been looking. Osiris is supposed to be Isis's brother, and yet she, they say, it descends from the star system of Sirius around the dog star, in which she's then called Isis Sotis. It's funny because there's Hey Diddle Diddle, the cat and the fiddle, the dog jumped over the moon. Isis is that dog, and the cat is Bast, and the fiddle, if you look at it, and such, looks like the Big Dipper or the Little Dipper. They look like a fiddle symbol, so that's interesting. Osiris, who is her brother, comes from Orion's belt, which is further on into the cosmos, into the galaxy, as it were. And yet they're called brothers and sisters. Always, all of them are depicted in different colors rather than human skin, which is interesting. When you see, I'm looking now at a statue, a relief that I have on my wall of the Pharaoh Seti. He is between Osiris, who's painted with a green face, and Ra, who, of course, is wearing a falcon mask. And if you look at it, and I am, the Menzies, which is the crown, the Menzies that they wear, and his Pharaoh's crown, kind of cover the fact that the Hepken face looks flatter, though, as though it were a mask, and that the headdress, the Menzies headdress, which is what King Tut wears, in case you're wondering, is much, you know, much larger than the head itself, which would lead one to believe it has another purpose. Many of the gods and goddesses also wear symbols upon their heads. Isis wears plumes and bullhorns and a steps on her head. It is an interesting thing, but that's how the Egyptians interpreted what they saw. What if it is, as I say, some kind of a space helmet? That you know, they don't have any other reference, so they're only taking the reference from Earth. So they don't have any other way to look at this. So they see, you know, symbol. They see something that looks like a horn or a feather or a steps or a bowl in some cases, and they're not sure what to make of that. So my theory, and many ancient alien theorists are saying, these things are possibly helmets or some kind of a device that helps the god or goddess or space traveler, as I'm suggesting, travel into the Earth's atmosphere and also differentiate them from the Earth dwellers, the natural people that are here. And this is not just in the Egyptian culture. I'm being selfish because my hobby, of course, and my passion is Egyptology. So I've looked at this from those eyes. I know, Hercules, you're probably looking at the same thing in the Olympian, in texts of the Olympians. And yes. And so you see the same thing, Zeus with his chariot and such. Very much the same kind of idea.
Yes, and actually we've explored this a little bit before. We're going to be exploring it a lot more throughout 2024. And that'll be one of the special focuses. And I'd like you to be the voice of Kemet in that regard as well.
I will be honored to be so. The one god I want to focus on tonight is a strange one. Khepra is a scarab. Now, all the other Egyptian deities are pictured with maybe a man or an animal's head. Khepra, it has on his shoulders and his neck the entire scarab beetle. His head is the scarab. And the scarab wears crowns. The scarab is seen with symbols above the actual, forgive me for saying, bug or beetle. But that always, to me, looked like a mask. Why would why would a being have a whole animal as its head? It made no sense to me. And unless, of course, it was some kind of an apparatus or some kind of a symbol that we don't understand now. Surely the same with ancient Greek texts. We don't, there are more ancient texts that the language is not exactly the same as modern Greek. Well, in hieroglyph, it's the same thing. We have expressions. We have, from each dynasty, different ways of putting things in words that are quite different than now, let's say, Arabic or Coptic Egyptian or, modern language in general. They're saying things that, we may be misinterpreting. Have you also found that in the Greeks? What do you think, Hercules?
Yes, there are texts, there are older texts, and there are things written in a language nobody's quite deciphered yet, although they believe it's an early form of Greek with linear A and linear B, which happened before the Phoenicians brought their alphabet, which the Greeks later evolved into their own thing, which spread to Italy afterwards and beyond. But yes, there are a lot of texts whose meanings we don't know, and there are some whose meanings we think we know, but the context in which these words were written is not always very clear, because we don't know the literary references. We don't know the mindset of the people who wrote it. So there's a lot that's still in question.
I am an avid reader of a magazine called KMT, which is Commit. And they've been talking about various and assorted dynastic hieroglyphs. Just as we in this era of the world have different kinds of slang. So
yes.
The Egyptians from dynasty to dynasty had different ways of putting their expressions. And so, you know, I'll give you an example. We talk about in Renaissance alliteration, the honored Moses. Well, when the Latins translated that from Aramaic, it was horned, not honored. And so Michelangelo, when he sculpted a great seated Moses, Moses has horns.
Yes, I saw that statue.
Because that's I've seen the statue, and it's kind of it's bizarre to see. The Roman Catholics were very mean, and they said, "Well, that's because Moses was a Jew," and that's absolutely disgusting and completely incorrect. You know, to say such a thing, it was literally a typo, and it caused Michelangelo to carve the statue in that fashion. So I'm wondering, did people who wrote about Khafre, the scarab, think the same kind of way, rather than giving the top of the beetle's head to the god, that, you know, making the entire beetle the deity's head, often in a better representation, at least I think, Khafre is shown as a whole scarab and is, you know, on the heart so that the heart doesn't speak what it shouldn't speak. The scarab is kind of a hush. There's a whole prayer, my heart, my mother, my heart. I remember talking to Carol Gonzalez about this many years ago, and it sticks in my head, how the scarab kind of covered over what one did in one's life. You know, there's a thing called negative confession in ancient Egyptian tradition, which is a lot like the Ten Commandments, only there's about 48. You didn't do this, you did that, you did this, on and on and on, including sleeping with one's livestock, I don't think is a good thing anyway. But the scarab, when placed over the heart, would keep the heart from saying things it shouldn't say in mummification. However, that's the mummy's body, correct? And it has magical powers. When the soul went to before the goddess Mat, who is the goddess of justice and balance and the truth, the heart was weighed. This is very symbolically the story of your life was weighed before the feather of truth. And if your heart was not light, and the heart was heavy, in other words, full of sin and sorrow and sadness and negative energy, and that the feather was lighter than the heart. In Egyptian traditions, there's a monster creature called Amit. She is a crocodile head, part of a lion and part of a hippopotamus, a hideous-looking creature. And, of course, she has a crazy wig also. Why would she not, right? And she eats the energy, and the being ceases to be reincarnated or ceases to go into the, you would say in the Greek, the Elysian fields.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I bringing this up? It's because this scarab is kind of a liar in a way, but he also, the mask, the head of the scarab, I think of as a deception also. You're not seeing what's behind it. You're not seeing the being behind that. And I'm wondering if they thought of it that way. We have no hieroglyph to say one way or the other. The scarab was created in their thoughts to be a being exactly the opposite of eternal life and reincarnation and life creation itself. You see, when a scarab, real scarabs roll around the desert with a ball of dung, usually camel dung, I think, or cow dung or what have you. They make a ball and they implant their eggs into this ball of, I won't use the language, dung. And after a while, the poor beetle gets tired, usually dies, and from out inside the ball, hundreds of scarabs come out. And so the Egyptians, the ancient primordial Egyptians, saw this and thought, oh my goodness, from nothing comes all these scarabs, not thinking it might have been impregnated or, you know, the bug laid eggs. They don't see that. They only saw, so they thought of the scarab as a regeneration. But then you have this contradiction of the scarab hiding, you know, all your bad feelings and your bad thoughts and perhaps your sins, as it were. So I'm wondering where, you know, where that confusion came or where that, or is that a different scarab? We don't have hieroglyphs to wonder one way or the other. Then you have, I'm going to jump around a little bit, but then you have the four protection goddesses. You have Isis, who is also kind of the goddess Isis, but a different one. And Nephthys, her sister, her twin sister, who is the goddess of shadows and mystery, and also the mistress of the eternal. She's the one, she's kind of, I would call Nephthys the closest thing, in your terms, Hercules, to Persephone. Because she works in the shadows, and she comes out in spring to give birth to her son, who is Anubis, the dog, the guardian of the soul. And although she comes into the world to do that, Anubis follows his father, who is Osiris, back into the immortal. So Anubis is invisible except when one is near death. And then he comes. He's kind of, I guess, in Christian terms or Jewish terms or Muslim terms, the angel of death in that way. But he also has a twin brother that's often forgotten, whose name is Apuat. Apuat is a silver dog. Anubis is supposed to be clad in a black jet or black tourmaline suit. And you don't really, you know, you see a naked black man and a black-faced dog, but the suit is supposed to be so tight to the skin that, you know, it looks like it's part of the skin. However, it's not. There are bracelets at the arms and legs, which I actually believe are the end of the costume, the suit. And I really do. I've looked at this. I have a statue of Anubis in front of me right now, and I'm looking at this thing, and he wears a collar and a kilt. And then at the upper and lower parts of the arm, there's a bracelet, and at the ankle, there's a bracelet. But it's, you know, if you look at paintings of Egyptian women, many times the gowns are sheer. Well, the statues, the one I'm looking at now is of his mother, Nephthys, and her gown is sheer. And so you can see, you know, every bump and curve in her body, although she's fully dressed. But I mean everything, and I do mean everything, including the nipples, and the genitals are quite visible in the statue, and she's wearing a gown. So I think it's possible also that what Anubis is showing, although it looked naked, may not be. And they say that his skin was the texture or the color of jet beads or black tourmaline or onyx, you know, and it had that shine to it. Rather more to me, like if one is wearing a leather suit or vinyl and it has a high shine, patent leather kind of thing. And that's what I'm looking at. And his brother, his twin brother, who is Apuat, wears a silver costume in the same way, a silver dog head and a silver, his body is silver. Like if you know about the Marvel superheroes and supervillains, the Silver Surfer, who's also, yeah, you know, always seen naked and silver and wears an interesting helmet. I'm looking at it that way. So here we have beings that are not like anything human, and they're here. And they're, you know, the Egyptians accepted them as kind of government, above their government. And it said that the pharaohs are descended from these beings. They're called the starry ones, the starry beings. Amun, Ra, Horus, et cetera, et cetera. Every pharaoh associates himself with the sun god, the son of the sun god, grandson, Horus. And you'll see on many statues, I'm thinking of Merneptah, Amenhotep, Thutmosis. You'll see the pharaohs on his throne, and behind his throne is a falcon, spreading his wings across the pharaoh's shoulders with his head slightly above the pharaoh's. And so they're intimating that, or, you know, saying the pharaoh is a descendant of this falcon, descendant of he's the son of Horus. He becomes Horus. And when they die, they say that the pharaoh unites with Osiris. He becomes the energy, or with the energy of Osiris. Because when Osiris was murdered and Isis put him back together again, there was a light in the heavens, and Isis, with some kind of energy, brought him, I would say, on a spaceship to be repaired. And, you know, we've been told many times that people that have been abducted, that they've been gone through medical procedures. I've read that, you know, eyesights have been repaired, high blood pressure has been lessened. One abductee even talked about hair restoration. I got to go find those aliens real quick. But I think that that's interesting. And, of course, there have been many negative things, too, said that they were probed and pulped and plunged and such for experiments. We don't know. I've never been abducted. I will say, had an encounter with a spirit. I don't know. I thought she was a spirit, but she turned out to be an alien. Her name was Vrel, F-V-R, possibly E-L. And she was all silver, except for a long white mane that stuck up on the top of her hat, her helmet or towel mask kind of thing. It was interesting. But to me, she looked Egyptian. She had eyes that were drawn like an Egyptian's with a liner. Her face was human but not human. And that's how they describe the gods and goddesses of Egypt, that they're not exactly human. They don't exactly look like us. The features are finer, better. I almost want to say as if they were carved more than alive. And that's why I'm thinking what even the statues of Isis and the statues of Hathor that supposedly look human, what if those were masks also? If that wig, you know, they all have those long wigs, they all wear collars, they all have a helmet and a gown of some sort. But I'm saying, and I mean it, I think now, based on my researches, that these beings, because they're all gold, their skin is not flesh tone. There's gold tone from head to toe. They're, you know, this metallic gold. We have I remember watching Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon, and the spacesuit was white and silver, you know? And I look and I'm thinking, what if we were primitive beings and we saw this on our planet? We would think it's not their a costume or a spacesuit. We would think it's their actual bodies. And I think that's what the Egyptians thought when they saw the gods and goddesses. Also, for instance, I'm looking at Isis now. The statue I'm looking at has a huge span of wings. We also know back in the 1970s, 1980s, as far back as the 1960s, they were dealing. We were dealing with those jet-propelled, one-man jet-propelled kind of things.
Yeah.
And some of them had wings. And I'm thinking, you know, for direction and for lift and such. And I'm wondering, is that what some of the Egyptian gods and goddesses did? Did she come to Earth on her jetpack? And the jetpack had huge wings.
During the reign of Kronos, which was a golden age on Earth, even though in folklore and mythology survives as a horrible monster, when he ruled the Earth, it was a golden age. And he had these beings called golden giants. And they were here to be shepherds to humanity. And they were not only in charge of helping humanity evolve, but also acted as spirit guides. So they helped in the evolution spiritually of humanity as well. And I found them, nobody talks about them. There isn't really much out there other than a few references. But I found tons of information in these space religions of today with the UFOs. There are groups that know all about them and what they're doing and what they've been doing and has stories that update their activities.
There are Native American tribes that I was just watching this, captured a group of giants with red hair, and they were at least 7 feet tall. And they got 7 or 8 of them into a cave, and with arrows and fire, you know, forced them to starve to death in the cave. And recently, a bunch of archaeologists got to this cave that was thought to be a myth, and they found red-haired, long red hair on corpses that are maybe 1,000, maybe 2,000, and not, as far as mummies go, very old. And these people are saying this was true. And now here they found this cave. They found these skulls, and the bodies are 7 or 8 feet long. And they're human-ish. And so my whole point is that they're going to, you know, that this is going to be happening. For real, I had to close my shrine. My little orange monster decided he was going to put himself in my shrine and knock the whole thing over. This is what happens when one becomes a cat daddy.
Yep.
And he's very knowledgeable. To bring him into things, Oliver was born on the 7th of May, and he is the same, that is the same day as the Feast of Bast. And so I think he was a gift from the goddess. It's kind of an interesting thing that, you know, here he is and he's getting huge. He, for a tabby cat, he's quite big, and he's only 8 months old and loaded with wonder. But there, another thing, in Egypt was the first place in the world that people had domesticated cats. And we do know cats have a very high intellect. And, you know, it was said of the people of Atlantis that they always kept cats around them to protect them. And he, my friend over here, he's never not by my side when I'm home. He sleeps right on the edge of my bed. Or last night he crawled into the blankets. I guess it was a little chilly. But he's very much, you know, protective of me. And I'm seeing that, did the aliens instill in these wild cats, you know, that it was okay to hang out with people? One of the very first companions we had, you know, as far as in the cave or in the temple or house, was a cat. Mm-hmm. Even before dogs, they found, you know, cat skulls and cat bones in temples and in primitive huts and such long before they found dog skulls. Yeah.
In countries like Bali, they were the temple guardians, the cats, and they physically guarded the temples and would attack people who would violate the temples.
In Thailand, for instance, also, the king and queen had Siamese cats all around them, and the cats were very much the guardians, even before dogs. So, and I always feel more protected when... staring up at me like, what are you saying, Daddy? when Oliver's around, I feel safe. Except that he does bite. He's only kidding because he's a kitten, but, you know, they play rough sometimes.
Yeah, they do.
He's growing out of it, I will say. But I find him, you know, like he's fascinated by my Egyptian statuary and the energy that he feels. And I can see he knows the energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, his a real out on a limb, did these beings that brought us all this knowledge, did they bring us cats? And I'm talking lions, tigers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I know they've been here for millions of years, but did they genetically alter them?
They may have, and many of the extraterrestrials are depicted in leonine forms, you know, sometimes lions with wings as well. And we have statuary like that for several Near Eastern gods who are lion-headed and winged. So,
the biggest one in the whole world, of course, is the Sphinx. And it's been said many, many times that the head of Khepra, or Cheops, if you wish, the pharaoh Cheops, that Khufu, that's his other name, that it's not his head that was there in the first place, but a gigantic lion, and that they later replaced it with the head of the pharaoh. The head of the stat of the pharaoh is too small for the body of the Sphinx. But we also have Sekhmet and Bast and Sakem, and there are many other lion or cat gods and goddesses in Egypt. But, you know, think about it. Lions and tigers are large, and cheetahs, and they're hard to handle. Maybe somebody one of the aliens genetically altered something like that so that they were, forgive me, but portable.
That's possible.
Smaller versions. Well, we create small dogs.
Yes, we do.
We've created pot-bellied pigs, pygmy goats, you know, and we're, I would say, way behind our alien ancestors, I think. We're catching up. We have millions of years to catch up with. But, you know, we've been out in space. We've been in space stations. We've been on the moon. There is... eventually, supposedly, a group going to Mars. Let's see. It's not that far away. I mean, it's millions of miles, but it's closer than, like, Jupiter or way out there in Pluto, you know, or Neptune. They're so far away and supposedly not inhabited. We don't know that. And I'm one of the people that believes, you know, they think, around 9 planets or so around the star Sirius, in between the two stars of Sirius, they find planets. We're not sure, though. We see things. You know, it's miles further, way further out than the sun.
Yes.
Orion's belt, we know that there may be planets out there, too. I mean, I'm not a silly person. I feel like the entire energy of the universe wouldn't just make life appear on one little planet. You know, I don't believe that. I really don't. I think life is a vast thing, and the energy is a vast thing, and that we're part of the cosmos. You know, we're not the reason for the cosmos. The ancients, all of them, you know, many of the cultures think about the Earth being like the center of everything. And although they worship the gods. It was more like the gods were there for their convenience. And I don't happen to agree with that thought.
No,
and that
do
way
I.
to do things. I mean, I'm going to get in trouble for this. There are a lot of people that worship spirits and positive and negative. But rather than being grateful for what they have, try to demand of those higher forces or command those higher forces that they can then harness that energy to make it do their bidding. And I know for thousands of years people have thought that, this spirit or that, forgive me using the word demon, but bring it down and you will then do what I want. And if the power of that energy is so much stronger than we, who are just little humans, I have a problem with that. It took me a long time to think about that. I was taught in a coven as a young man, young kid, to harness those kind of energies. It was part of our traditions, to stand in a circle and put the spirit, the demon, whatever you want to call it, into a triangle or a square and forbid the creature, whatever it was, to move from there till we told it it could. And I'm looking at this that did the aliens teach our primitive ancestors to be able to harness certain loose free agent spirits or free agent energies at the time to get them to do that? That not that they're higher power or stronger than we are. It's just they have the ability to transmute maybe different levels of consciousness, different dimensions in the universe than we do, being landlocked or spirit locked, physical locked. I'm quite an expert on astral projection, and I am able to travel, but of course my body's not with me.
Right.
So I believe these spirit beings, these demons, what have you, or whatever you want to call them, may not have physical bodies or can leave their bodies as we do, but in such a way that they can manifest in somewhat physical form because their energy is stronger than ours and we can see them. But I think that ancient aliens may have taught us to do that. That's what I'm getting at. How do you feel about that?
I've never wanted to imprison and command any type of spirit. And again, whatever you want to call it is a good way of referring to it, because some of the explanations for what these beings are that, these are guesses, for the most part. But I know that there are techniques where you can do that, and I've never been interested in doing that. I'm not really a ritualist. Few times I've done ritual that involved inviting beings to what I was doing, to the circle I was in. I would not dismiss them. They were free to go back wherever they wanted, but they came, so they're guests, and they were treated as such. I'm not really very much into commanding anybody or anything, to do my will. I'd much rather cooperate with people and with entities and work on something we both want to do rather than command them to do something and keep them imprisoned or uncomfortable until what you want gets done.
I always think of, the genie in the bottle or
yes.
The spirit. In Africa, in West Africa, they're known to have what they call spirit jars where they've
yes.
commanded an energy of some sort. And I think even in ancient Greece and Rome, they have bottles where they put a spirit and, open it only to command the poor being who then is bound by some kind of ritual. And magic, if you wish to use the word, to force that being back into the bottle or back into the whatever it is, coffin or vessel or bracelet or ring, to then later on again do their bidding. And as you say, I'm not in love with that idea. I think it's very angry, negative karma to hurt something else. that suddenly is forced to be your servant, your slave.
Your servant. Yes, your slave.
And I don't agree with that. But there is a theory that the ancient aliens, gods and goddesses, also put us here or altered our genetic makeup as we were evolving. They felt we needed to evolve a little faster. I was re-watching something just now on Ancient Aliens, and they were talking about the rapid growth and change in evolution from the primordial primate people to suddenly Homo habilis, and then Cro-Magnon, and then bingo, Homo sapiens sapien. And they say we've only been around 30,000 years, and that's not possible. They've got, you know, cultures that are older than that. So I'm questioning that. You know, did an alien suddenly genetically alter us? But to make us to do tasks and had purposes for us to do things on the earth. There was a movie John Travolta did called Planet Earth, where aliens came down and took mutant humans that were kind of, some were better than others. The ones that weren't better than others became lunch, apparently. And the ones that were able to think and were then given kind of like shock treatment and, what would you call them? Kind of like electronic knowledge planted into their brains. And they were able to prosper more, and they were to help these other beings who were gathering materials and minerals and gemstones and such from the earth before they would go and leave the earth barren again, as they apparently did to other planets. It's an L. Ron Hubbard kind of a thing, I believe. He helped write, because John Travolta did this, and of course he's Scientologist.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
It's a Scientology thing. So, you know, I mean...
Yes, John Travolta was in Spaceship Earth, I think it was called, or something like that.
Yeah, something like that, exactly. And so it was... Some people interpret it as a post-apocalypse that we fought and were defeated by, and then other people are saying... is prehistoric, that, you know, the aliens came and they took over and started to teach the better ones of us, the more intellectual ones of us. And they, as I said, they used the rest of us as food, that we're no more, you know, and that's a theory for certain species of human being extinct as they came lunch. You know, that struck me as strange.
Yeah, there.
And then you have.
In the future, we're going to get into some of those theories. But yeah, there are a lot of theories. Some of them dating back to antiquity that we are our energies, if not us personally, are food for gods or aliens. That's why some people believe that the gods were vampires of some sort.
I've heard this theory also, but then also that many of us that have psychic abilities were granted by genetics throughout time a more advanced ability to accept their technology, and that's actually what ESP and psychic phenomenon actually is that we have absorbed that energy somewhat better than others. That's why some people have more psychic abilities than others, and that others have various psychic abilities as opposed to others that do not. I don't know what to say about that. I was able to do things as a young child, psychically, that some of them I stopped. Telekinesis, for instance, is one of the things my mother would have told you that I could do. There's an episode when I was about 4 where she came upstairs to my room to just put my brother down for his night sleep. He was only a year old. And she saw all my stuffed animals walking around on my bed. And the next morning, she threw them all out.
Ooh.
She didn't know. Yeah, they were stiff. They were expensive. But she said that something was wrong with them. They didn't smell right or they didn't feel right. And I knew what happened. I had been visited by an energy. And he, his name was Johnny, said to me, Michael, bring them up. And I opened the toy chest with my mind and had them like a Noah's Ark. And there were a zebra, a giraffe, an elephant, a seal, a lion, a tiger, a teddy bear. And they all came over onto the bed. And she was just coming into my room. And, you know, when I was, the focus was stopped, the animals fell flat on my bed. But she saw the move. I know she did. And I, you know, I was so frightened I never did it again. But I was only 4 years old. And I know, I remember specifically that night, you know, it was probably around 8:30 or 9. You know, you're a parent. You put the kids to bed early. At least back in the day they did. My neighbors upstairs do not. 8 o'clock, I had to go to bed. You know, before, way before sunset, I was made to go to bed. After we ate dinner, maybe I watched a cartoon. And that was it. We went to bed. My mother would close the door, and that was it. And I was told to go into what was called velvet darkness. The black, that it wasn't scary, that it was warming and comforting and helping and would help me to sleep. And that's how I was taught. And, you know, I'm wondering where my mom got that idea. Everybody else I knew as a little kid had to have a nightlight. I didn't. Uh-huh. I welcomed the darkness. It made me feel good. It made me feel safe, kind of like a black velvet blanket. That's how I looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
My mother also with me did shadows on the wall. She taught me how to make my fingers into animals and things and stuff. But I looked at that as kind of a form of magic in a way, because she was doing things that nobody, I never heard any of my friends' mothers do that. And my mother's mother was a witch. She practiced very strong magic. And I'm wondering if that was part of it. You know, I mean, rabbits, dogs, cats. Think about it. You know, a rabbit, there's an Egyptian Hekwa who's a rabbit goddess. And dogs, well, I have Anubis, and cats, you have Bast. My mom said she didn't believe in, quote unquote, all that. But her mother did. So, I mean, I'm not sure what to think of that. And my mom's not around to ask. In fact, none of my parents or my uncles and aunts, they're all gone. So there's a big gap in my thinking in those energies.
I know what you mean with that. I have several gaps because people died before they could share them or chose not to share them for reasons of their own.
But my mom, you know, when I was little, I had Egyptian statuary that I bought. There was a place in Roosevelt Field, which is Garden City, Long Island, and it had statues. It was World Imports, it was called, not Pier 1, World Imports. And they had soapstone statues of all the Greek gods and goddesses. And after a while, they had black basalt or black soapstone statues from Egypt of the gods and goddesses, too. And I have some of them still. I have a statue of Amun that I kept all these years. But they had an energy to me. The Greek statues were made in Greece,
mm-hmm.
not China, like now. And the Egyptian statues were made in Egypt. And they were very, I mean, I was a little kid. They were inexpensive.
Right.
World Imports was also known for its, they had boxes, blue, green, yellow, orange, red, clear plastic boxes. And even though they were just plastic, there was an energy.
Mm-hmm.
I was understanding the color spectrum at that time. I was knowing that certain colors could do certain things. Blue for healing, green for growth, red for passion. Those are things I was learning those energies were put into my head. I don't know where they came from, but I learned them just because I heard the voices. And I, you know, later on when I was working with the coven, those energies were confirmed to me, but I already knew them. Where do you think that energy came from? Was it a past life, or did I actually have some kind of a connection to some spirit, higher forces?
I think it could be a combination of those things.
Many things when I was being taught about spells and rituals and the time, the wheel of the year, as it were, these things I already knew before I ever heard the answers. The Egyptian Eye of Horus, Utchat it's called, the magical amulet, the most powerful in Egypt. I knew what that was before anybody identified it for me. I knew its name, and I knew how to draw it. I knew exactly what that was. And I do attribute that to Conwes, to one of my past lives. I really do. I knew what that was because I wore it. It was an amulet that I wore around my neck, and still do, every day. But I knew that was part of me. That's kind of an odd thing, don't you think? To know something by name and by the way it's drawn and what it is before I was ever, you know, confirmed by a teacher or, you know, by looking it up, I knew what it was. And I felt myself blessed that that was true. I wish my teacher would come forward one day and say, yes, Michael did know that. But he won't. He's become very different. There is an opportunity between us. And that's the only way I'll put that. I don't bear him any ill will.
No.
And I'm sure he doesn't. No. You know, you outgrow people sometimes. That's all that is. As a young man, I had to realize that. He chose one path, I chose another, and we went on our way.
And that's fine.
It's natural. You know, just as you leave your parents when you marry, or you go out in school, you go out in the world, it's the same thing when you leave a teacher. Socrates once said, discover your own path. And I know that that's true. And in my case, I've been, all my life I studied Pythagoras and Ptolemy and Archimedes, who are Greek but Egyptian. And I have that connection with you, that Greco-Egyptian connection,
yes.
The Alexandrian connection. I do believe that I was at one time or other involved with the Library of Alexandria, and I still feel that connection, even though it's Egyptian.
I keep trying to build libraries, and I get involved with libraries, and I do things with or for libraries. So I feel that connection as well.
It is to that goal that I thought to build the Perneteru, the temple. It means the temple of the gods.
Mm-hmm.
Nefret Neteru is gods. And I don't just mean the Egyptian pantheon. That was the mistake people understood. That's where I'm comfortable. But I want to work with the entire world. I want to know mythologies. And that's what brought us together, because we're of like mind that way. We want to create something that will bring the ancient knowledge into the modern world and use for today. I mean, all of that knowledge was lost during the Dark Ages, as it were. People kept thinking the gods and goddesses were evil, which is weird. And they also looked at the knowledge that the Romans and the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Etruscans and the Persians and the Arabs all had as evil. It wasn't their Judeo-Christian tradition, as if that was the only thing there was in the world. And, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb again and say, there's a book, a play called Inherit the Wind, which is one of my favorite plays. And Clarence Darrow, who it's really about, and the Scopes trial, the evolution trial, says the Bible is a book. It's a very good book, but it's not the only book. And that's where I go. That's where my head is, that, you know, We have the Bhagavad Gita. We have the Book of the Dead. We have all those texts the Greeks had and the Romans and all that knowledge from all over the world. And it's all part of bringing the world together as one. And I think that's our goal. Alexander the Great said, I'm going to shut up quick, but Alexander the Great said, to create us in a spiritual nation, one people, one nation in the universe living in peace. I want that. I want to be part of that, and I know you do too.
One nation. So many people out there, and unfortunately, we have less than 4 minutes left, and I'd like people to share your world. So if you can tell them how they can reach you, that would be fantastic.
I'm sorry I was so verbal, but yes.
No, okay.
MK Waterman at iCloud.com, Michael K. Waterman on Facebook, Phone a Wizard on Facebook, Makeup for You and More 53 on Instagram. You can get me on my number, which will not change. I've had this phone number 23 years, and I can't change it now. It's 516-650-3691, and you can ask for Michael or Conwes. You can also reach me, of course, always through Hercules Invictus as well.
Yes, they can. Sorry about that. Well, thank you very much, Setna, and as always, I enjoy our conversations, and you gave an excellent one today, full of information, well worth pondering and researching further. And I'm going to invite you to be on one of our early episodes of the Celestial Mission show. And I want to focus on your Celestial Mission during that time as well.
Excellent. Thank you.
And I will talk
to everybody,
very soon. I believe on Tuesday.
We'll be together on the 12th. Yes, the 12th we'll speak again.
Well, thank you, and thanks to our wonderful listeners. Whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called and you patiently waited in our queue, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures, and congratulations, Conwes, for all the wonderful things that are happening to you, and I look forward to speaking with you in Georgia.
Absolutely. I'm going to be the vamp of Savannah, VA.
There you go. Thank you.
Blessings all.
Blessings.